In 1997, Tim Howard and his best friend Brian Day were avid drug users in the small town of Ashdown, Arkansas. Brian dealt drugs to support his habit, and it was no secret that he was in debt to some major players. On December 13th, 1997, an anonymous caller notified police that a U-Haul parked on property owned by Tim Howard's family was dripping blood. When police cracked the padlock, they found Brian Day severely beaten and shot with a .38 caliber bullet. When police went to tell Brian's wife, Shannon, the bad news, they found her lifeless body in a closet under a mattress. The couple's 7-month-old boy, Trevor, was zipped into a duffel bag with an electrical cord wrapped around his neck, miraculously still alive. Tim knew about the drug deal Brian had coordinated that must have gone bad, so he understandably fled town, as did 10 other people in Ashdown's underworld. Despite many obvious leads for the investigation, including aggressive characters seen making threats against Brian and Shannon just days before the murders, police zeroed in on their only black friend, Tim Howard, and his flighty behavior. With no physical evidence whatsoever connecting Tim to the crime that couldn't be explained away by his close friendship with the Days, the state conjured up a motive completely based in fantasy, stirring up a visceral response from the jury. That, along with a clear Brady violation, would send Tim Howard to death row. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me, I'm your host, and today I'm extremely excited to have two amazing, amazing guests, both heroes of mine, John Harden, who is a private investigator and the co-founder and director of Proclaim Justice, an organization on whose board I proudly serve, and he is has a background in public affairs and political consulting, and he was a tremendous advocate for the West Memphis Three. So, John, welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
And today, the star of our show is Tim Howard. Tim was wrongfully convicted in, not exonerated, but paroled on December 13th of 2017. As I always say, I'm sorry you're here, but I'm happy you're here. So welcome to Wrongful Conviction, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Yeah, and Tim, this case came with instructions. None of the signs pointed to you, and yet you ended up serving 20 years. So getting right into it, so this is December 13th of 1997. An anonymous caller notified the Little River County Sheriff's Office that blood was dripping from a U-Haul rental truck parked on property owned by the family of Tim Howard on a farm in southwest Arkansas in a little town called Ogden, population 126, right? And when deputies arrived on the scene and they cracked the truck's padlock, they found Brian Day's body inside. He had been severely beaten and shot with a .38 caliber bullet. When they went to the Day's home to give his wife Shannon the bad news, things got a lot worse. Her lifeless body was found slumped in a closet under a mattress, and the couple's 7-month-old child, the baby, Trevor Day, was found in was found in a zip duffel bag with an electrical cord tied around his neck, but by some miracle, he was alive. And then things get really weird because 4 days later, Timothy Lamont Howard, who's right here on the show with us now, was arrested and charged with the murders of the Days, as well as the attempted murder of their son, Trevor. And this is where I got to start scratching my head and go, Tim, I mean, or John, whoever wants to take this, what evidence did they have to connect you to these murders?
Well, starting out, nothing. I mean, they said it was my behavior, but I guess I did the same thing other people done when we found out what had happened. We all kind of fled and waited for the dust to settle because, you know, we were all in illegal activities in our little circle, so to speak. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand why they considered me a suspect because me and Brian were close. We were best friends, and we were together that night on and off. But when it got down to evidence gathering, it was just all circumstantial, and they just ran with it. They quit looking.
And you guys were involved with drugs, but did you have a violent history or past?
No. I've been to jail for a speeding ticket my whole life. I don't have any arrests for any kind of violence, and I was a happy-go-lucky kind of guy. I mean, at best, you could say I was a drug user or a womanizer and that type thing, but no violence in my history at all.
Right, and this is a brutally violent crime. I mean, this is not something that somebody just flies off the handle and goes and murders a whole family. It is a miracle that the little boy was alive. And John, I mean, I want to turn to you for a second because the victim himself, he was involved in some really shady stuff. There were reasons for people to want to kill him. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Brian was involved in drug dealing, and you know, we were able to uncover a lot of things in our investigation that really suggested that he owed a lot of money, big money, to maybe some not good characters. And that is a much more likely scenario, given the nature of the crime, that it was something related to him owing money to sort of higher-end drug dealers. And there's a couple of possibilities as to, you know, who actually did the crime.
Well, and let's talk about this, right? Because 2 weeks before the murders, Brian was arrested alongside another dealer. His name was Mike May. And it was rumored that Brian may have avoided jail time by snitching, right? We know how people react to that in the underworld. There were also witnesses who had witnessed violent and quote-unquote unpleasant individuals arguing with the Days about money in the week leading up to the murders. And just days before the murders, Shannon Day was heard saying that if anything happened to her or Brian, of course, Shannon was his wife, it would be Kenny Chicken Fields, who was one of Brian's main suppliers, who would be responsible. But authorities somehow managed to overlook all of these potential suspects. And they zeroed in on the Day's only black friend, Tim Howard. Now, you know, it's hard not to say that there may have been some inherent bias towards Tim because he is a person of color in a place that was not very racially diverse. But what's interesting is, Tim, you were so close to them, and they made a big deal out of this because, of course, some of your biological evidence was in their house because he was your best friend, right?
Yes.
And when I say he was your best friend, to the extent that you actually accompanied his wife to the hospital when she went into labor, right?
Yes.
And he was out scoring meth, and you took her to the hospital. I mean, that's a pretty close friend. I don't know who would do a thing like that other than somebody's best friend. So, Tim, they had what they considered to be evidence, which was your fingerprints on a Mountain Dew bottle found inside the home of the victims, and also your fingerprints in or on the truck. But that's easily understandable and easily explained by the fact that you were literally best friends and you were in and out of the house all the time.
Yes, I mean, well, at one point we actually lived right across the street from each other. I mean, the thing about it was, when they said biological evidence in the house, had they looked, I have clothes in the closet, shoes, you know, because I'm in and out. And here's the same thing at my house. He had clothes at my house. I mean, so naturally, it would have been odd not to find my fingerprints or anything else around the house.
And meanwhile, your defense argued, which would seem to be a good argument, basically what we had said before, which was that Brian was heavily in debt and was killed by drug dealers who were tired of his shenanigans, right? I mean, that's, you know, that would seem to be a valid theory. But meanwhile, the prosecution, they theorized and they advanced the theory, actually, I should say, they accused you of killing him in a quote-unquote meth-induced rage, right? Because they said you wanted money. And then this is where it gets to be ridiculous, right? Is that their theory was that you had been upset after hearing that Shannon might have been pregnant with your baby, even though, and I know this might be a sensitive topic, but even though you were sterile, right? It was known that you were sterile because you had found out a couple of years earlier.
I knew for several years before that I couldn't have kids. Me and my wife at the time had tried. So we went to a doctor to find out why. And the sad part about it is, but when they put that theory forward to the jury, they knew it wasn't true because it was in the notes when the medical examiner called them and said, look, she just finished her menstrual, you know, that she was absolutely not pregnant. But they still advanced that theory because it inflamed the jury. But as far as other drug dealers there in Ashdown that he owed money to, like the Kenny Chicken Fields, the town was so small to where everybody grew up together and they went to school together. And, you know, their families have been around there forever. And when you get locked up in a place like that and they have a capital trial, they give you two lawyers. You got to take a local counsel and they give you one out of Little Rock. My attorney out of Little Rock was Matt Carter at the time. Great attorney, you know, just overwhelmed with this case. And he had a ton of other cases at the same time. But my local counsel, when Matt brought up the name Kenny Chicken Fields, the first thing my local attorney says, oh, well, you know, he wouldn't do anything like this. and this is the guy that's supposed to be on my side, you know. So at that particular time, I had thought, you know, he's telling this other side everything that we're doing now. I mean, if you're going to defend somebody that you ain't even investigated yet because you grew up with them, I mean, I don't stand a chance here.
But then there's another thing, which is actually kind of weird, which is this whole thing with the work boots that were found like 2 miles from the crime scene. Can one of you guys explain that whole aspect of this?
I can explain it to a point. Okay, when we went to get this U-Haul truck, I was to take it to my house. So I use it like a vehicle. I had boots sitting in the floor along with a bag and several other objects as I drove around town. And left it in there because the truck was going to be with Brian. When they found these boots, they're down at the bottom of a ravine a couple of miles from the crime scene. There's blood on these boots, so they tested them. They found what they called at the time mitochondrial DNA that said that this was 99% mine. But there were also other hairs in this boot that matched nobody. It didn't match me. It didn't match Brian or any of the girls that were with me at the time. And they had no idea who it was. But the prosecutor's idea was I drove by this ravine in such a panic and I just threw them out the window. And, you know, it's 200 or 300 feet down to this place. They said I was trying to hit the water. They alluded that this is where the murder weapon is, which they never found. And from the way they're explained, there are actual footprint leading from the boots. Somebody put them there. Why? We don't know. At best, you can say somebody used them to do the murder in or put them on after to do whatever so they wouldn't get blood on their shoes. But they put my ex-wife up there testifying, yes, I bought him these boots back during this time. And we offered him all my clothes that I was wearing that night. They wouldn't take. They never took because they said the person should have been a bloody mess.
You also had this ridiculous forensic quote-unquote scientist. This would be laughable if it wasn't so serious. But, and this really didn't come up till later, right? Because in 2011, and I want to get back to the trial, but when the handwritten notes came out from the DNA technician who had testified at your trial, the notes printed on the lab reports, which were over the course of 3 months in 1999, back when you were on trial, contained phrases such as cap had flipped open while spinning, source of the problem, gel did not run properly, inadvertently erased, and of course, random spurious contaminant. It's ridiculous.
And the real kicker is, you know, the prosecution had those notes from the lab technician and they withheld them from Tim's defense team. So that's ultimately how we got his conviction overturned, was discovering that Brady violation. That was evidence that the state should have disclosed and turned over, and they did not, and we had to go back in and find those notes, and that's really what led to the conviction being overturned.
Listening to this story, it has now occurred to me that they used the DNA testing to prove that those were your boots. Then they find and ignore another contributor of the boots that is not you, Brian, or anyone in your immediate circle, but likely the actual killer's DNA. I mean, they had the freaking lead that they needed to get the real killer. And the irony of the whole situation is that if they weren't so damn incompetent and shady in their attempt to get a conviction, you would be dead right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you know at the time you were facing a possible death sentence?
I had no idea that it was going to go as far as it did. And even when they formally arrested me, still, I thought, well, okay, well, I'll get out on bond and we'll figure it out. Up until I met Matt Carter, and he told me, hey, you're facing a death penalty. I mean, I was floored.
As the trial unwound, you had this one attorney who was basically not only not doing a great job for you, but was almost serving as an adjunct prosecutor. And you had evidence being withheld. There was a lot of dirty tricks going on. You knew you were innocent. But when the jury went out, how long did they deliberate for?
It wasn't very long. But one of the things about that is, and don't get me wrong, I wasn't an angel to start with. I was, like I say, a womanizer, a thief, and a drug user. But I wasn't a killer. But as far as the trial, It only lasted like 3 days. So while they were out deliberating, the sheriff and his deputies came up and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. When they give the verdict, we're going to take you and your family through this tunnel, and we're going to put y'all in the car so nobody has to see y'all when you leave. Even he didn't think I was getting convicted. They were making an escape plan then. When the jury came back and said guilty, one of the deputies that when I first got locked up, that me and him couldn't stand each other, we had become the best of friends. He broke down and started crying. He just couldn't believe it. I was in shock because I just like, they proved nothing with all that they went through. As far as how you feel, you just kind of numb because it all goes so quickly, because after the verdict, they give the verdict, they whisk you out that night and take you straight to death row, you know, the very next morning.
Well, I just want to go back for a second because we can't skim over or gloss over the thing about the sheriff. So the sheriff was an adversary of yours, if I'm understanding you correctly, when you first went in there. And by the time the trial came around, he was so convinced of your innocence, he was preparing to put you through the back tunnel with your family. And he was, you're saying he cried when the verdict was read?
Yes. When I first got locked up, as a matter of fact, when Danny Russell became sheriff, I was his first call out. I was at a motel with a particular young lady. Her sister, who I was living with at the time, came down and set my clothes on fire outside of the hotel room. And Danny came down on the first call, and he said, man, what'd you do? And he talked to me and talked through it, and we kind of, you know, laughed about it and went on. He arrested her, but he said, I'll let her go. If you call him, I'm going to come get her. But when he arrested me for this years later, this girl was my girlfriend at the time still, and we got married in his jail. But he got to know me the first 3 months. In jail, you know how phone calls and everything gets expensive in there. He allowed my family to buy a phone card where I could come up every night and call my children. And the guard who I told you I couldn't stand at the time, his name was Mike Malum. We became the best friend. He went to get stuff for my daughter for the prom. I mean, paid for her dress itself. When my kids come up to visit, he made a special deal where they could come back there and see me in their office. I mean, so I guess I'm saying it to say this. Yes, I had a tough ordeal in the jail, but as I got to know the people who stayed there all that time, it's hard not to get attached to each other. When they see who you really are, I guess what you could say.
Well, that speaks to your character as well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to know that that type of friendship developed, and moreover, that the sheriff himself became so convinced of your innocence. John, in this case, how could the jury have gotten it so wrong that even the sheriff who, you know, went into this obviously with a preconceived notion that Tim was guilty, how could they have gotten it so wrong?
Well, you know, I think there's a few things at play here, and me being a native Arkansan, I can speak to some of the racial components in the whole state and Little River County, Ashdown, Ogden. Listen, the game was rigged to start with. At Tim's first trial and his second trial all these years later, it was still a thing of, you know, Tim being a black man, dates white women, dresses more, you know, like a cowboy, boots, hat, you know, cowboy hat, the whole nine yards. I mean, it was the jury's of both trials were picked and designed to have that prejudice. And I think that went a long ways to convicting Tim. It was heavy on emotions. I mean, when you've got, you know, the husband and wife who are brutally killed, but then you've got, you know, a 7-month-old child, it was just a very emotional trial, both of them.
Well, you got the prosecutor who, in his closing arguments, saying stuff like, the last thing this mother seen was him standing there and her baby hanging by a cord.
Yes.
Was her last. I mean, who would not be enraged?
Right. So it was so heavy on the emotional side rather than the evidence side. Then we did have this racial component that went with it. And, you know, Jason, as you know, I mean, juries just sometimes they can't sniff it all out. And this is one of those times where I think they were so emotional about the tragedy, particularly for Trevor, that they couldn't see beyond it.
So, Tim, you're convicted, taken to death row the next day. And can you explain what death row was like?
It is, a lot of people say, well, go in your bathroom and shut the door and you find out what it's like. You can, in a sense, but the difference is you won't get the feeling of death row because you can open your bathroom door at any time. There are people down there who were there when I first got there. They are not the same people now. Before I left, they lost their mind.
It's crazy to me that everybody doesn't lose their mind in that scenario, yeah, including you. I mean, it's remarkable, the human spirit, and I hear it in your voice. It's unbelievable.
But I want to make one thing perfectly clear. I didn't do this by myself. I had a great support team. I mean, you get letters when you go to death row all the time from different people. And of course, most of them are curiosity seekers, so they don't last very long. But I got a letter from a lady named Linda Bassett, who is now married to Mara Leverett. But I now call this woman my mother. She sent me a letter and she says, here's $25. She was running a thing called a court bulletin at the time. If you want to write back, here's some money for stamps. If you don't, here's money for commissary or whatever. Just know somebody's out here thinking about you. I started writing to her and we started a pen pal relationship type thing. And she's a great teacher and a great person to talk to. But she never wrote a prisoner in her life. The only reason I feel like I'm saying now is because of the people who stepped in once I got there when they heard what was going on. And I got the first 4-3 decision on my direct appeal that ever happened.
So, Tim, can you take us through how the appeals process worked?
Okay, when you first get to death row, you have what you call a direct appeal. And that happens within the first year that you're there. And usually it's rubber stamped and it's usually 7-0, 6-1 or something like that. My first attorney's name was Janice Vaughn. She was a civil attorney, retired. Now, unbeknownst to me at the time, that was the best thing that ever happened to me because this woman is meticulous. With her research, she's the first one that found these notes and put them in my direct appeal. She put everything up at the kitchen sink and it comes back with this 4-3 decision. Mara Leverett came in, she wrote an article and people started paying attention because of there's never been a 4-3 decision in a death row case ever. My whole process takes off from there. And John and Proclaim got involved and it was just, I can't tell you all the things they did because I wasn't there, but I know they worked a lot of hours going here, going there, interviewing this witness, interviewing that witness. And it takes more than 2 people. It takes more than 3 people. I mean, it's a whole village that's got to do this.
So, you know, we got involved early on through Mara. Mara and her wife, Linda, that Tim was referring to, Mara called me and said, John, listen, you and Jason are just starting this organization, and this is the first case out of the gate. And so we immediately started reviewing. When Mara Leverett asked me to review something, I review something, you know. And Tim's right. We did a lot of investigation.
So, John, was the key that led to Tim being granted the second trial that ultimately turned out to be so consequential?
Yeah, the biggest thing that we turned up that really led to this new trial was it was a direct Brady violation from the state. We had these handwritten notes from the DNA technician where she put in there that the samples were contaminated, and that was not disclosed to Tim's defense team. So once we discovered that, that was really the smoking gun, so to speak, that led to the new trial.
Janice is telling me this whole time, Tim, you're eventually going to get a new trial. We just got to find you the right lawyer.
So that was around 2011 when you found out about the Brady violation and filed a petition with the Arkansas Supreme Court. Then sometime around 2013, Patrick Banka started representing Tim.
If you're going to have one lawyer in Arkansas, in the whole state, that you want on a case like this is Patrick Banka. So Mara and I talked to Patrick and he took the case and we were able to help him investigate the case and give a lot of support.
You know, Patrick Banka at the time did a hell of a lot of work. And sitting in the court, we came for a hearing and there's nobody in the courtroom but the prosecutor, me and my lawyers and, a few family members. The judge at the time, he's sitting there and he's reading up this stuff about this article, about these caps and about that. And he says, as much as it pains me, and I look up, I'm like, what's he fixing to say? And he kind of goes along those lines, and he's fixing to do something he really don't want to do. And he says, well, we're going to have to give Mr. Howard a new trial. And I about fell over. I did not believe what he had just said. Mm-hmm. And it went from there. And my second trial, like I said, and it was a whole lot different from the first. It was like watching a lawyer on TV. I mean, he was extremely thorough. If there was a blood expert up there, you thought he was a blood expert. Mm-hmm. If there was a gun expert there, you thought Patrick was a gun expert. And he wasn't the only one there. There was a lady from the Public Defender's Commission named Kate Street. Excellent job. And they went through each witness against me one by one and discredited him.
Yeah. At his second trial, he was charged with 3 capital crimes, 3 first-degree crimes, 3 second-degree crimes. And after a 2.5 week trial, the jury got the case the Friday night of Mother's Day weekend or Father's Day?
Mother's Day weekend.
Mother's Day weekend. The Friday night of Mother's Day weekend. And we had some indication from jury questions that there's probably going to be a compromise verdict. And sure enough, that's what happened. So at about midnight on Friday night, after a 2.5 week trial, they came down and acquitted Tim of all the first degree charges, acquitted him of all the capital charges, convicted him of second degree charges with the idea that his sentence would amount to time served. And so that was the compromise that the jury had reached after this long ordeal on this holiday weekend. And we've confirmed that with jurors, you know, who were supportive of Tim after that verdict, who were sending him money and all kinds of things. So Tim is actually not exonerated. It's one of these imperfect situations, Jason, that we know so much about, where he's off of death row, he's a free man, he's sitting here with us right now, but it's an imperfect solution.
And I want it known that they gave me that. I didn't accept anything. I'm still telling everybody I'm innocent. It wasn't one of those things where, okay, we got this deal. Here's what you got to take. This is what they came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked specific questions. They even signed a piece of paper saying, we expect for him to go back to prison to get a number and be let out within 2 weeks. This is what we agreed to. Which, of course, that didn't happen. I had to spend another 2 years in prison after all of my rigmarole. After my conviction, I became friends with a few of the jurors and found out what it was like in that jury room. You know, it's just, the compromise was, okay, we don't believe you did it, but we believe you know who did. It's not telling us, so you're not, you know, leaving here scot-free. It was a compromise that if they hadn't made, they'd have had a hung jury. And the ones who were supporting me thought, if he has to come back, what if he gets another jury that convicts him again? All together, you know, everybody against him. So they didn't want to take that chance.
And they also didn't want to stay Mother's Day weekend.
Yeah, you know, that, and that was exactly it. So they wanted to go home to their kids. One girl even broke down crying there, and she was for me at first. She changed her mind because she said she was just tired of arguing and she wanted to go home to her kids. She was willing to send me to prison because she was tired and ready to go home to her kids. Not because she believed, because she was on my side at first.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Tim, ultimately, it took until over 2 years later, December 13th of 2017, Tim Howard was finally granted parole over 20 years after his wrongful conviction and released from prison and home in time for Christmas. With all the villains in this story and all the, you know, all the people who either mistreated you, let you down, who turned out to be either corrupt or incompetent or dishonest. There are a lot of heroes in this story too. And Patrick's certainly one of them. John, the proclaimed justice people. There are some jurors, obviously, who stuck by their guns and in spite of the pressure I'm sure they felt in the jury room, it's clear from hearing exactly what happened that they knew you were innocent and they wanted to do the right thing, but there are probably a couple of people in there that just were refusing, and that's not excusable, but it's good to recognize the people who come out in this story. Even the woman who wrote to you gave you hope. I mean, there's a lot of good from this, and you're here as a result of those people. So that's actually a good reason to turn to John, because before we get to the wrap-up of the show, John, can you talk about Proclaim Justice? Because you guys have been doing amazing work. I would say, you know, batting above your weight, or whatever that phrase is, right? There have been quite a few exonerations that have come from the work that you and Jason and your team have done. I've enjoyed dealing with you both as a member of the board and also as someone who's worked with you on cases. Talk about Proclaim Justice, and if you could, tell people how they can get involved, whether it's as simple as sending a check or going to a website or getting involved on a deeper level.
Yeah, so we were born out of the West Memphis 3 case. I was an activist in the West Memphis 3 case, and once we got those guys out, Jason Baldwin and I talked about starting. We wanted to keep that network together of notable people, of, you know, folks all over the world who had supported that case, and we just had the idea to start this organization and try to keep that network together to advocate for other victims of wrongful conviction. So we started this after Jason and Damian and Jesse got out of prison, and Tim was our first case, you know, right out of the gate. So yeah, we are a small organization, but we do good work. I've got great people on my team, great investigators, lawyers in our network. You know, we try to run very efficiently for our clients, and we try purposefully not to take on too many because we're interested in their post-release condition and the whole thing. So maybe sometimes our resources are spent on making sure their lives are settled once they're out. How people can get involved is go to proclaimjustice.org. And you can read about some of our cases that we're currently working on and how to get involved. These cases are very expensive. They take a long time to work. You know, continued financial support. You can donate from the site as well. That goes a long ways. So I would just encourage people to visit our site and learn how to get involved from there. And you know what? Tim can speak to this. A small thing that people can do that just goes so far is writing the people who are in prison for something they didn't do. So they can, you know, write our clients, they can find the addresses and all that stuff on our website. And I think that little bit of encouragement goes a long way, and it's something easy for people to do.
So that's proclaimjustice.org.
I would go a step further to say, even John said with writing to people who are innocent, I'm going to say write to people, period, because the guys that's on death row now, even the ones that are guilty, they're not the same person that they were when they got locked up. Some are better, some are worse. Find a person to give them some kind of hope. I mean, because there are some really, really good guys there who made a bad decision. I mean, and there's still some guys there who I consider friends. I mean, if they was to get out tomorrow, they're working in my home.
Tim, I'm glad you said what you said, because I'm going to quote the great Bryan Stevenson, who said, "I believe everyone's better than the worst thing they've ever done." So that being said, this is the part of our show called Closing Arguments, where I get to thank John and Tim for taking time out of their day and sharing their story and their wisdom and experience. And then I get to kick back, turn my microphone off, and just listen and let each of you have the final word. John, you're up first, so fire away. Closing arguments, go.
One of the great honors of my life in this work is sitting beside a guy like Tim Howard. I tell people that other than maybe my son being born, the best days of my life are when I get to sit beside somebody who we collectively have worked so hard to get out. It's the most rewarding thing. And it's important for people to know that this is just not uncommon, unfortunately. I mean, there's a lot of Tim Howards in the world that are still in there. And, you know, we're working hard for them. Join the fight with us. Every little bit helps. You can follow along with our endeavors at Proclaim Justice on Twitter and on Instagram. There's always updates with what's going on with Tim and Daniel and other folks that we freed and other folks that we're working to free.
And now over to you, Tim, for closing arguments.
All right, well, people like Proclaim, they don't just drop you when you get out. They still try to help you along. I've had a few bumps in the road, and they've been there for me. Just like Linda Bassett, my mom, and Mara Leverett, Janice Vaughn, Patrick Pinker. All these people who came into my life, they're still there. And I just want to say thank you to all of those people. Everybody that's in my life now, the people at my job at Galley Support Innovations, I have two great bosses, Wade and Gina Radke, who believe in second chances and have been so gracious and went above board to support me as I go through what I'm going through now. I just want to say thanks. And to even the people that I don't know who helped me in different spots and different times, please just step in and do what you can when you can. And if I can help you in some way, let me know. As far as being on social media, I haven't got that down pat yet. I mean, I got a Facebook page, but I don't really post on it a lot because there's always pushback on. I'll get pushback for this interview in some way, somehow, but that's cool too. I mean, nobody's got to believe what I say, but just believe the situation.
don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps. And you know, I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause, and in so doing, helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. It's easy. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I want to thank our amazing producers, engineers, and editors, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1 and PRX.